You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today, we'll be listening to a presentation on Egypt by John Van Auken. John Van Auken is an internationally renowned speaker, longtime staff member, current director at ARE, and the popular leader of ARE's life-changing tours to Egypt and other sacred sites. He is the author of several best-selling books, including From Karma to Grace, Edgar Cayce and the Kabbalah, and his newest, Edgar Cayce's Tales of Ancient Egypt, and is a regular contributor to Venture Inward magazine. His extensive knowledge of the Cayce readings, world religions, Gnosticism, and ancient Egyptian mysticism is combined with years of experience as a teacher and meditation retreat leader. He is presenting the new experiential program, Egyptian Mysticism and Initiation, Awakening the Initiate Within You, based on his new book, in Virginia Beach, from January 27th to the 28th, 2012. To find out more, go to edgarcayce.org, click on Events, and then click on Conferences. To find out more about his newest book, Edgar Cayce's Tales of Ancient Egypt, go to arecatalog.com.
Now, Cayce begins his Tales of Ancient Egypt with so many past lives, but one of his greatest stories is the daughter of Hatshepsut, or as my British friends like to call her, Hot Chicken Soup. She is the greatest of all female pharaohs, and there were female pharaohs. Her story begins with the god, the creation god, Ptah. So it's pronounced as though it was spelled P-A, but it's Ptah. And there's Ptah, beautiful, one of my favorite Egyptian gods. And the legend tells how an unseen consciousness within the infinite darkness dreamed of the creation in his hidden heart. It's a great story. Very similar. Tomorrow you're going to hear the Mayan creations are very similar. But his heart, from his heart, he spoke the sound of qualities. Very similar to Hinduism, right? And thus the creation appeared in the darkness. This was the heart of Ptah, meaning the opener. In the sense of opening the heart and then the mouth to sound the names of the manifested creation. So reminiscent of Genesis' naming of the creatures. Do you remember God brings our androgynous Adamic self before and says, you need to find a companion in this duality. So I want you to see all the expressions of creation and see if there's one, and you name them as you see them. And none was found. So the companion was found within himself. It was the Kava. Where are we here? As the creation progressed from dream and heart to physical manifestation, and that's just the way Cayce said it occurred, the original creation was conceived in the infinite, still, unmoved consciousness of God. Then that consciousness moved and it conceived. But these were not physical things. These were thoughts. These were concepts. Light. Playing with light. Star. Playing with star galaxies. Spinning out. All the way down to where light on pebbles in a little brook. This is the way it came. In Genesis 1, God created everything. In Genesis 2, nothing was manifest. A mist had to arose from the earth before all of it became physical, and God had to put the man in the garden. You were not there yet. So you were created in the mind of God. And that helps so much when you're meditating. If you think of the reality realm of the ultimate as the mind of God, very helpful. Ptah became the primordial mind of earth upon which physical creation began. The original mound was called Tatenin. Now, of course, the other one was the Benben mound. That you have different names for the same thing. Ptah, Tatenin, is the, quote, source of food, divine offerings, all good things, end quote. And his realms
and his realms were the deep regions beneath the earth, quote, from which everything emerges, including plants, vegetables, and minerals. Everything is the work of Ptah's heart and speech. Gods are born, towns are founded, and order is maintained. He is also, quote, the ear that hears, end quote, prayers. The ear that hears prayers. And Pharaoh Hatshepsut was the beauty of Ptah. The story goes like this. Amon-Ra, now Amon-Ra is the invisible god. Ra is the visible. Amon or Amun-Ra is the invisible god, hidden. Amun-Ra, king of the gods, sat upon his throne and looked upon the land of Egypt, and he spoke, saying, I will create a queen to rule over Tamari, the beautiful land. I will unite the two lands, upper and lower Egypt, in peace for her, and in her hands I will place the whole world, Egypt and Syria, Nubia and Punt, which is northern Somalia, land of perfumes, by the way. The land of the gods shall be under her sway. And when he had spoken, there was silence among the gods. While he yet spoke, Thoth, Hermes, entered into his presence. Thoth, the maker of magic, the lord of Hermopolis, the city of Hermes, he listened to the words of Amun-Ra, king of the gods, and in the silence that followed, Thoth spoke. O Amun-Ra, or Amon-Ra, lord of the thrones of the two lands, king of the gods, maker of humans, behold, in the black land, that was Egypt, the black was the silt. So when the Nile flooded and then it retreated, it left black, rich silt all over the soil. That's why it was called the black land. Kemet, which in Egyptian means black land. In the palace of the king is a maiden, fair and beautiful is she in all her limbs. Ahmes, also called Amos, is her name. And she is wife to the king of Egypt, Thutmose the first. She alone can be the mother of the great queen. So here the gods, like the angel Gabriel, come upon a female that is capable of channeling the incarnation of a goddess. Whom thou wilt create to rule over the two lands. She is in the palace of the king. Come, let's go to her. So the gods descend out of heaven. In the palace of the king of Egypt was Queen Ahmes. And it was night. She lay upon her couch and sleep was upon her eyelids. Like a jewel was she in her beauty. And the chamber in which she slept was like the setting of the jewel. Black bronze, electrum, which is this goldish associated with what do you call that stuff in Jurassic Park? Park that the amber associated with amber, you know, the color of amberish. Electrum, acacia wood. They say acacia, we say acacia wood, and ebony were the adornments of the palace, and her couch was in the form of a fierce lion. They loved that in Egypt. They liked to sleep on the lion. The fragrance of her of the perfumes of Punt filled the chamber, and Queen Ahmes awoke and beheld Amun-Ra, king of the gods, maker of humans. In majesty and beauty he appeared before her, and her heart was filled with joy. He held towards her the sign of life. So just like you saw Hermes reach the Ankh towards the incarnate Pharaoh and he inhaled it, he reaches the Ankh towards her. And in her hand he laid the sign of life and the scepter of power. And Neith and Selk lifted the couch on which the queen reposed and held it high in the air that she might be raised above the ground on which mortal men live, while she spoke with the immortal God. That's all it took, folks. She was pregnant. Amun-Ra returned and was enthroned among the gods, and he summoned to his presence Khnum, the creation God. He was he who fashions the bodies of humans. He uses a potter's wheel. O Khnum, fashioner of human bodies, fashion for me my daughter. She shall be the great queen of Egypt, for I will give to her all life and satisfaction, all stability, and all joy of heart forever. Khnum, the creator, the fashioner of bodies of humans, the dweller by the cataract. That means Aswan, Egypt, the cataract. Made answer to Amun-Ra, I will form for thee thy daughter, and her form shall be more glorious than the gods for the greatness of her dignity as king of south and north. Then he brought his potter's wheel and took clay, and with his hands he fashioned the body of the daughter of the queen Aames and the body of her Ka. Two bodies, the twin.
We'll be right back with more with John Van Auken on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with John Van Auken.
And the body of the child and the body of the Ka were alike in their limbs and their faces, and none but the gods could know them apart. Beautiful were they with the body of Amon-Ra. More glorious were they than the gods. Then Khnum, the fashioner of the bodies of humans, and Hek, the goddess of birth, came to the palace of the king of Egypt, and with them came Isis, the great mother, and her sister Nephthys, the keeper of the secret place. Meskhent, goddess of childbirth and the birthing place. Also Ta'urt, protectress of pregnant women and infants, and Bes, the protector of children and households. The spirits of Pe and the spirits of Dep, two spirits that created two dwelling places that then were merged into one. Now, what would they be inside yourself? Please take the veil away for a while. You see? The two realities become one. And you, as you go on your spiritual path, I know many of you have already had this happen, you start to turn that veil from opaque to transparent. And more things are coming to you intuitively. How many of you have been driving down the road and suddenly a brilliant insight comes to you? And then if you don't write it down, you get into the parking lot, you can't remember it at all. I had a brilliant insight. I have no idea what it is. They came to greet the daughter of Amun-Ra and Queen Aames. Mes means to be born of, expressed of. And its icon is the flow of water from heaven. And when the children appeared, the goddess rejoiced. When the child appeared, the goddesses rejoiced, and the spirits of Pe and the spirit of Dep chanted praises to her honor, for the daughter of Amun-Ra was to sit upon the throne of Horus of the living and rule the land of Egypt to the glory of the gods. Hatshepsut was she called, chief of noble women. Some people translate it the most noble of noble women. Divine of the diadems. The two crowns, favorite of the goddesses, beloved of Amun-Ra, the unseen, the hidden god. Now, isn't that very feminine? See, the unseen in a female, that's the inner. The female is the inner. The male is the outer projected. And to her, the gods granted that she should be mistress of all lands within the circuit of the sun, and that she should appear as king upon the throne of Horus before the glories of the great house, and upon her was the favor of Amun-Ra forever. Now, Cayce, in his Egyptian tales, includes Hatshepsut, painting her as a most spiritual light and connecting her to Moses' search for God and the Promised Land. Though the Bible develops the Moses story extensively, there is little physical evidence to support the biblical existence of Moses and Israelite slaves in Egypt, and even an exodus of Israelites out of Egypt. There is nothing. There is one stela in all of the collections of Egypt in which there's one little part, and you look right at the bottom, and it just says Israel is done. That's it. You know, it doesn't give you any more detail at all. Most scholars date the biblical Exodus to 1445 BC. Curiously, Edgar Cayce's readings of the Akashic Record also point to this time and period and connect Moses with one of the greatest females in Egyptian history, Pharaoh Hatshepsut, who ruled from 1479 to 1458 as king of Upper and Lower Egypt. She was the third woman to be Pharaoh. The others were Merneith, who ruled from 3050 to 3000 BC, and Sobek Neferu, who ruled from 1806 to 1802 BC. Egypt did not pass over females when it came to who was heir to the throne. The eldest child possessing the royal blood was the heir. Whether it be a daughter or a son, inherited the throne. Guys who wanted to be pharaoh and were politically savvy would quickly try to connect themselves with a blood female of the line and then claim to be mated with her, and therefore they could also be pharaoh. Of course, there were more famous Egyptian women, such as Queen Nefertiti, wife of Pharaoh Akhenaten, and Cleopatra the Seventh. She was Pharaoh. She wasn't. Everybody says queen. That's not right. She was Pharaoh. Pharaoh Hatshepsut had more power than these two women. Hatshepsut's two-decade rule was the longest among ancient Egyptian women at a time of the New Kingdom's golden age. She is said to have amassed enormous wealth, channeling it into building projects and launched military campaigns. Her stela in Karnak is the biggest, most magnificent stela in all of Egypt. It is unbelievable. I mean, her obelisk. Let's see, where am I? Cayce readings indicate that Hatshepsut and her daughter Sidiptu left Egypt with Moses and the Israelites to search for God in the promised land. Now, the legend in Egypt is Pharaoh Hatshepsut disappeared. That's what they say. Now, of course, tour guides will say to you that the males finally got a hold of her and killed her. But according to Edgar Cayce, no, they didn't. She and her daughter were so into spirituality and searching for God that when they found out what Moses was going to do and Joshua, they went with them. All right, here are some of the greatest characters in ancient Egyptian tale: Ra-Ta, high priest of Egypt; Isris, originally a dancer of the temple of such beauty and spiritual magnificence, later she became a goddess in her own right; Ara-Ara-Art, a very long name for one of the great pharaohs; Ararat, a native scribe sage of ancient Egypt. Scribe sage. It meant an educated one who recorded and all, but he was also illuminated, a sage. And Hepsut. Now, some people say Suft, but most people say Hepsut. And it literally means help shut up. And he was the sealer of all the records. You'll see that in a minute as the story unfolds here. And here they are revealed. Now I can reveal them. There are no secrets. Ra-Ta, of course, the high priest, was Edgar Cayce. Isris was Gertrude Evans Cayce. Pharaoh Ara-Ara-Art was Hugh Lynn Cayce. Ararat was Mort Blumenthal. Hepsut was Ernest Zentgroff. And now here's a little more about it. Cayce in the reading said, Ra-Ta awakened to the Ra within him. Isris awakened to the Isis within her. Now, some people think that Cayce said that Ra-Ta was Ra. But I think if you read this carefully, Ra manifested through Ra-Ta when he eventually reached his ultimate illumination, though when he was younger, he had the Ra consciousness. And Isris awakened to the Isis within her. And some people think Gertrude was Isis, but I feel that She was in the sense that Isis was manifesting through her. It's kind of like the way Casey talked about Jesus Christ. He said Christ was the spirit, Jesus was the man. You see? So the spirit of Isis was in Isis. The spirit of Ra was coming through the man Rata. And the whole story is in much greater detail in here. When the high priest Rata was decrepit, and that word was particularly used by Casey, and it usually means worn out by age or by long period of time, he entered the temple and rejuvenated his body to live another 100 years and build the great pyramid with Hermes. Pretty impressive there. The whole story is in here, but this is part of the Casey tale that this high priest. When Isis returned to Egypt from banishment, she built the Sphinx as a monument to that era and to the high priest, Rata, who had become her companion. The two became great illuminating leaders at this time. Now that's a pretty big role. So here's the Great Pyramid and the Second Pyramid. And if you're familiar, here's the Sphinx. And this is the Sphinx Pit. This is the Sphinx Temple. This is the Valley Temple and the Causeway going up to the Second Pyramid. Khufu and Khafre. And right about here is where that shaft going 90 meters down into the earth, into those beautiful chambers with sarcophagi, is located that we talked about a few years back. This is the Great Pyramid over here. Close up of the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple and the Sphinx Pit, see? It's one solid block of bedrock. However, when you go visit it now, the archaeologists have covered it in stone blocks, so it looks like it's made of stone blocks. But it was actually carved down in the bedrock. See this rock? This is bedrock. So what they did was they kept the bedrock and made this one complete piece of statue out of bedrock sitting on bedrock. Amazing piece of skillful stonework. And this is, of course, the Valley Temple, where if you've seen my talk about Hall of Records, you know I think it's over in here right off that right front, Paul. But that's just me. Now, part of our tale includes the birth of Rata, and it's a fascinating story. I know it's tough for you to sit through this, but this is what the talk was supposed to be about, so hang in there.
We'll be right back with more with John Van Auken on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with John Van Auken.
Edgar Casey's visions contain many detailed stories of ancient prehistoric times with dates, events, and named people. He was very good at this, and dates. His Egyptian narrative begins with the strange tale about a discarnate soul looking for just the right opportunity to begin anew during the second creation. This was the spirit that eventually became Edgar Casey. This soul's mind scanned the recovering planet from beyond the veil of material consciousness, and it saw that the migrants from the former lands and peoples of Og were now living on and around Mount Ararat in Turkey, where Noah's Ark is thought to have landed. Mount Ararat is in modern-day Turkey. Og was one of the principal regions of Atlantis, according to Casey, and the area known today as that of the American Plateaus or north portion of the U.S. state of New Mexico and the surrounding highlands or mesas in that area. These migrants from Atlantis retained the spiritual ideals of the earlier children of the Law of One, as Casey called them, indicating that they retained the belief that an unseen oneness connected all life. Now, let me help you a little bit. You're thinking, oh, God, the Southwest U.S. was part of Atlantis in the Atlantic. But remember, it's a tectonic plate, the North American tectonic plate. It could have been way over near the Atlantic. Do you see? I was just led an ARE tour to Iceland, and I stood on the North American plate moving east and the Eurasian plate moving the North American plate moving west and the Eurasian plate moving east. It's still moving. Energy's coming up out of the earth. It's fantastic. But do you see what that means? Let's backtrack about 10,000, 12,000 years. It could have been a lot closer to the lands of Atlantis, okay? And that's where the Hopi were guided to go to, by the way, the mesas in Arizona area. The children of the law of one, are you guys familiar with that concept? The sons of Belial and the children of the law of one. Casey said there were two main philosophical soul groups in those days. One said, get all the gusto you can get, every man for himself, survival of the fittest. The strong should subordinate the weak, use them as slaves, whatever you want to do. That's the way it should be. Look around. There's nothing but multiplicity. I'm strong, you're weak, too bad. The other group were called the children of the law of one, who said, no, 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 we're all one. It appears that there's differences here and that we're in different levels of power and strength and enlightenment, but the truth is we're all one. Now, that was really hard to sell, especially when the sons of Belial were having so much fun. That was really hard. In fact, Edgar said in the Atlantean temples, some of the purest, most wonderful priestesses and priests who were of high attunement and all were so subtly swayed towards the fun of the sons of Belial that it became very hard to hold on to your spiritual ideals. And I'm sure some of us here appreciate and understand that. Certainly not me, but I mean... The celestial soul, observing through the veil, intuitively knew that this Ararat clan would eventually come down out of the great mountain and surrounding lands, enter the region we know as Egypt, and begin the wondrous era of creativity, productivity, and enlightenment we see in surviving Egyptian temples, pyramids, papyruses, and statuary. This was the opportunity that the extraterrestrial soul was seeking. However, knowing that a prophet has little honor in his own tribe, the soul searched beyond the Ararat clan for a way to come to these people from another group. Casey's vision described a people in the Far East known as the tribe of Zu, in what would be known today as the high plateaus of the Mongolian lands. These people were also refugees of the destruction of the first creation, but they were from sunken Lemuria in the Pacific. Strangely, these people and those in India had ideals and sacred rituals that would eventually become part of Egypt's early culture. When Edgar Casey was asked, what was the highest moment of illumination on the planet? He said, now, it depends on what you're using to judge. But moments in Lemuria. Now, I know a lot of us think, oh, Atlantis was the highest. But he did say in the readings, Lemuria. And these were high spiritual. By the way, the root word of Lemuria can be traced back to a lemur. But it's not the monkey. It's the Latin word that means ghost. These Lemurians were not incarnate. Casey made that clear. Don't misunderstand it. These people were not in bodies encased like you and me. Now the Hopi have this legend. They said that the door to heaven was open in those times and you could come and go when you wanted. You manifest here. You had to manifest, but you could manifest in a ghostly form. In a holographic light projection of yourself, you could commune telepathically a lot. Remember, the Hopi were spoken to through the soft spot in their heads. So, this was a pretty high-level group he bumped into. Among the Zu clan was a daughter of their leader, whose body, heart, and mind were perfect for the incarnation of this powerful celestial soul. Her name was Arda. She was pure, selfless, portal into this world. Thus, with love and idealism, the celestial spirit overshadowed the young girl and persuaded her deeper self and the very cells of her body to yield to his coming. Having a more fourth-dimensional mind and heart, Arda responded, and the spark of the spirit of life quickened her three-dimensional womb. Though a virgin, having known no human man, she conceived a new and ideal physical body through which the celestial soul could incarnate into this terrestrial world to fulfill its grand mission. Fascinating, amazing female portal into this dimension. She had a fourth-dimensional mind and heart. Edgar Cayce, occasionally, when he would start a reading, you know, he would put his hands over his forehead and he'd see a point of white light. As soon as he saw that, he'd move his hands down over his solar plexus and he would start to go into deep breathing and REM, rapid eye movement. You had to give him the suggestion to do the reading then, or he'd fall asleep on you, have a dream, no reading. So you had to watch him like this. Well, sometimes when he would start a reading for a person, he would say, "Oh my, a fourth dimensional mind, how refreshing." And apparently Arda was of that level. Arda was exhilarated by the new life within her, yet she was uncertain how her people would receive the news. You can imagine. Hopeful, she explained to them what had happened. Unfortunately, her kinsmen could not share in her belief in a celestial conception. They drove her from the tribe in shame, Cayce tells us. Her father, confused by his ready to believe anything love for her, and yet his rigid hold to the laws of his tribe and the realities of this physical world, a three-dimensional mind, stood motionless as she was driven off. Cayce details how she journeyed westward, but not by some thought-out plan, but by an inner, intuitive push west. Eventually, she camped near the tribe living on and around Mount Ararat. The Ararats, remnant Atlanteans, had no love for the tribe of Zu, remnant of Lemurians, so Arda was not welcome, but she was tolerated. However, when that child was born, and his beauty perceived by the people of Ararat, she was tolerated a little better. The child grew in stature and wisdom, revealing a knowing that quickly identified him as a prophet, a seer. In one of the young boy's pronouncements, he prophesied the entrance of the clan into the rich lands of Egypt and that they would build one of the greatest cultures on the planet. And the Ararats liked that prophecy. Here it is, a map to kind of give you an idea. This is the area of Mount Ararat and the surrounding lands. Arda traveled from over here to this. She was eventually accepted into the clan. Now, the planet was not heavily populated like you and I. Edgar said 133 million people were on the planet. And the tribe of Ararat were 900. Egypt was only a few thousand. It was very much a starting over. The planet was not highly inhabited at the time. So down they travel into Egypt, and they begin the culture. Here are some of the high priests. See, when they finally arrive, the king of the Ararat tribe appoints Rata to be the high priest of the whole land because he is the one with the greatest illumination. Rata was teaching that this inner life was important and worth knowing and developing. However, most of the natives held more strongly to the material outer life and the enjoyment of it, very similar to Children of the Law 1 versus Sons of Belial. Rather than seeking some unseen inner life, the natives of the Black Land were a materialistic people, Cayce says.
We'll be right back with more with John Van Auken on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with John Van Auken.
Rata brought a new teaching, one difficult to comprehend from a strictly worldly perspective. Even so, the people remembered how he had manifested remarkable abilities during his early years in the Black Land and how he had led people on archaeological expeditions that found very ancient artifacts of the first creation peoples. So he was capturing their hearts and minds gradually. His reputation grew and many natives began to listen to him and attempted to understand his strange ideas and mystical practices.
That was an excerpt from John Van Auken's presentation on Egypt. And now I'll read an excerpt from his book, Edgar Casey's Tales of Ancient Egypt. Chapter 1. A Ray of Sunlight on Earth. In ancient times, a mega flood, an eruption of a supervolcano, a succession of powerful earthquakes, and a shower of fiery meteorites brought an end to the mythological lands of Lemuria, Mu, in the Pacific Ocean, and Atlantis in the Atlantic. According to Casey's visions, remnants of these prehistoric peoples migrated to safe lands and played a role in the rise of new civilizations, including the extraordinary people of ancient Egypt. Egyptian legends tell of receding floodwaters and the descent of the heron from heaven. It was called the Bennu bird, the phoenix of Egyptian lore. According to this legend, the Bennu bird was the soul of the sun god Re. The soul of Re, in the form of the heron from heaven, landed on the primordial Benben mound that rose from the inundation of the chaos occurring in the latter period of the first creation. Upon landing, the Bennu cried out, "I am the Bennu bird, the heart soul of Re, the guide of the gods to the Duat." The Duat is the underworld in Egyptian teachings, the land of the night, corresponding to the subconscious realms of our minds, lying just beneath daily consciousness, behind a veil that separates our earthly awareness from our soulful heavenly consciousness. The Bennu's cry marked the beginning of the second creation. The drying Benben mound upon which the Bennu settled was in the ancient land of On, a place known today as Heliopolis, City of the Sun, near modern-day Cairo. In this manner, the light of heaven came to earth. Thus Egypt was born from the ashes of the first creation. This tale may be compared to the biblical first creation of Adam and the lands he and his families knew. Then, when the first creation spread darkness, filling in the hearts and minds with all manner of evil, the great flood cleansed away the first creation, as described in Genesis 6. After this cleansing, the biblical story tells of a new beginning with Noah and his families. Thus began the second creation. That was an excerpt from John Van Auken's book, Edgar Casey's Tales of Ancient Egypt. To find out more, go to arecatalog.com. And now it's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Kimberly Rose. Kimberly Rose currently has her sessions involving the Crystalline Consciousness Technique on sale at half price. She's also going to be teaching a class for mediumship in January. To find out more, go to KimmyRose.com. That's KimmyRose.com. Well, hello.
Hello.
And what's today's thought for the day?
This is reading 2729. That portion of thy body which is of the earth, earthly remains with the earth, but that thou hast glorified, that thou hast used as a channel for the manifestations of his spirit, of thy soul in communion with him, that body will be raised with him in righteousness, that the physical body became ensnared and tangled in those things in the earth, through the gratifying of those desires that are fleshly alone, those that are carnal, is manifested by dis-ease, the corruption, the turmoil, the strife that arises within the experience of each soul in its thoughtful activities in the earth. I love that. It's long. I mean, there's a lot to it.
Oh, yes.
But it's like when you really think about it, when we are in dis-ease with ourself, you know, it's really easy to really, you know, catch ourselves going, you know, well, when I get to heaven, I'm going to find it's going to be so much better. When I get to heaven, I'm going to be happy. But it really is about heaven in on earth, that we chose to be in our physical bodies. And we also have our, like Edgar Cayce talked about, our, we have our spirit, you know, and we have our soul, you know, and those two are connected all at once at the physical time. So we are in communion with God at all times. People think that in order to commune with God, you need to raise yourself up to this other level, but it's, God's always there. And the physical body sometimes gets all ensnared, entangled, confused with things that are so earthly, and they forget that heaven is part of them also on earth.
Oh, yes. I was actually thinking about that the past couple of days. It's interesting. Some people, yes, they think they have to go to a special place or raise their spirituality in order to talk to God. But if you look in the New Testament, the people that walked up to Jesus and asked for things, like the centurion or the woman who just touched him for healing, they weren't priests. They weren't, you know, in a church or somewhere like that. They were talking directly to God, coming from their viewpoint of just being regular people. And God didn't say, I won't do it because you're not holy enough. He did it because they asked and had faith. So we have to remember that, even if we feel bad or down, and even if we're not at church or somewhere where we're meditating, or, you know, we feel spiritual, we can still ask God and he'll hear us.
Yes. And that's the truth. That's the truth no matter where you are.
Well, thanks for doing the thought for the day today.
Thank you. Have a good week.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to John Van Auken for his presentation on ancient Egypt. To find out more about his book, Edgar Cayce's Tales of Ancient Egypt, go to arecatalog.com. Thanks also to Kimberly Rose for the thought for the day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce.